Hello, it's Tuesday the 21st of January 2020. It's Gareth Mitchell here with Ghislaine Boddington again.
Again, yes.
This week. Yeah, so we're kind of out of sequence because we do
alternate
between you and Bill.
Me and Bill, and it's us slightly rearranging things so we can both fit in other work bits.
Yes.
But thank you for coping with that, Gareth.
And we have lives outside Digital Planet.
We do have lives outside Digital Planet, but we're definitely with you between us every week, one of us. Yeah.
Are we the most important thing you do out of your many functions?
Absolutely, totally.
Correct,
I love
answer.
It.
Couldn't resist it. We will jump into the programme really quickly. We've got a lot on the menu today. We're going to be talking about internet shutdowns. We're going to be talking about this, seeming disinformation campaign in Australia. So lots to come. But I did want to, Ghislaine, just before we get into the programme, hear the listener's voice. As you know, I'm very keen to do this because there has been a response to our discussion last week about the bushfires in Australia. And we looked at the tech response to it, like the amateur radio community, and also quite a lot of work on like the more of the these sensors that can look out for changes in temperature and pollution and feed that back to servers. So that's what we did.
And there's an amazing app.
Yes, yeah,
that
absolutely.
That seems to be
fires
very
near me
popular,
app.
Very, very needed, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So that sparked a few comments on the on our Facebook group. So that's BBC Digital Planet on Facebook if you want to come and find us. Conrad Brahm is a regular poster, very loyal listener. He is talking about smoke damage there, and he talks about the sensitive electronics in some of these stations that are up on hilltops, for instance. One of our contributors from last week in the amateur radio community sent me a picture of a burnt out radio, like mobile phone station.
Yes, I saw you put that onto the listeners group, didn't you?
It's quite harrowing.
It is quite harrowing.
You can
actually
just see, you know, it was just reduced the whole thing just to like a melted, molten, not very good looking piece of kit. And people's mobile phone communications depend on towers like this that are often in places where the bushfires have been at their worst. So Conrad Brahm saw that and he said, okay, even if it doesn't get hot, then surely enough smoke getting into the equipment will damage the sensitive electronics. So that was a comment from Conrad. Let's just get one as well. Yeah, Chris Edge says, yes, a massive thanks to the Wison guys. So this is the amateur radio community. So they go by the acronym Wison. He says, yeah, massive thanks to the Wison guys for their efforts to restore comms. The sheer size of the fires down here in Australia has been staggering. Also, the heat generated to melt steel is quite scary. I'm up in Queensland, says Chris, and we've been lucky with only a few fires, which we had back in November, and they were able to get them under control within a few weeks. So that's a few listener comments, but let's get this one from Sam Quinn as well. He says, living here in Sydney, the pollution and ash from the fires has truly been awful for the last couple of months, and we've only received just the output of the fires, just the smoke. So happy to report rainfall, says Sam, the first I can remember in a very long time. So yes, and it is a he. I've just checked if that profile picture is anything to go by. That's Sam in Sydney.
And it was good to hear that the rain came, although of course it's still not solving things, and as we talked about last week, it's actually there's still loads of problems even after the fires go out, because it's the ongoing pollution and debris and many issues onwards.
Floods and landslips now in some regions, so
housing and everything, and animals stranded in the middle of nowhere, and
as we'll hear in the programme, a disinformation campaign, it seems, as well, just to make things even worse. Yeah, have a nice day, folks. Enjoy the programme. Here it is. This is what our show sounded like on the radio this week. Hello, this is Digital Planet. I'm Gareth Mitchell. Today, the cost of internet shutdowns around the world, climate change denial disinformation breaks out, and how to get a whole new language online. And also, we're going to be talking about your these worm-like robots. Gosh, Ghislaine Boddington's going to give us some comment this week as well, if we're good. Hello, Ghislaine.
Hello, Gareth. Good to be here.
Good to see you again. Now, first, let's jump in with a massive figure. $8 billion. Wow. That's the cost of internet shutdowns in the last year. Yes, these things are pretty frequent, as you will indeed know if you're a regular Digital Planeter. In recent times, we told you about outages in Chad, Iraq, Iran, the DRC, Zimbabwe, to name just a few. Now, this particularly new report that's come out with that $8 billion figure, it comes from the Top 10 VPN website, where Simon Miliano is head of research. And first of all, I want to ask you, what is a VPN? Because it's a way that people get around some of these shutdowns. So beginner's guide to VPNs, please.
Well, the VPN stands for Virtual Private Network. And it's just a simple piece of software for your laptop or your phone that creates an encrypted connection to the internet, taking you via a virtual server somewhere else, changing your IP address, which, of course, you know, hides who you are.
Yeah, and it's not surprising that when a country chooses to shut down its internet, there will be costs. You've added up all the costs from the major shutdowns, 122 of them over the last year, and come up with an overall figure of $8 billion. Where does that figure come from?
That's a big figure, I grant you. But if anything, it's a conservative view. It's an underestimate. We only looked at national shutdowns and regional shutdowns. So we didn't look at all of the super local shutdowns in India, of which there were almost 100 that we didn't look at. Nor do we look at the longer term impacts, such as, you know, the effect on tourism or, you know, loss of investor confidence, for example, which I think would take that figure much, much higher.
So that's what you don't look at. So what do you look at?
So we looked at total internet blackouts, where there's no internet connections at all, and where social media platforms such as Twitter and Facebook, WhatsApp, were shut down. Yeah. And we only looked at ones that affected either a whole country or a major region.
Okay.
A country like India, which obviously massive.
Because to explain to the listeners, this isn't like a study from the London School of Economics or the Harvard Business School. You are a website that refers people to VPNs. And I just wonder if you have a business case for talking up the impact of shutdowns. But you're saying, if anything, we're talking it down.
Indeed, we wanted to make sure that it was a really robust and credible report. So we didn't want to overinflate that figure at all.
Yeah. And what about the other economic costs of the shutdowns? Are you looking at things like just lost productivity? Can you take that into account? I don't know, lost advertising revenue, just the big impacts?
We used a publicly available tool that had been developed by NetBlocks, a very well-respected non-profit group, and the Internet Society, that looked at lots of different economic factors, particularly around GDP and economic output. And we fed our detailed data set into that tool, and this is what it spat out.
Right. So were you surprised? $8 billion? Because when I read it out, I wasn't surprised it was a big number, but I had no idea it would be quite that massive.
I thought it might be bigger.
Right, okay, right. Fair enough. Yeah. Now, also here from your organisation is Samuel Woodhams, Global Digital Rights Lead. So, Sam, a blunt question then. Why does it matter? It impacts, there are economic factors and so on, but internet shutdowns, in terms of people's everyday lives, what their right to express themselves?
I mean, the effects of internet shutdowns are huge. We've obviously focused in this report on the way that that's hurt the economy of these countries. But there's also several other significant, if not more important, issues. Focusing on the economic aspect of this is an important way to advance the narrative and the way that we speak about it, because we know that regimes that are restricting the internet access in their country know that we know that they'll care about the amount of money it's costing them. The other things that it's affecting is obviously violating fundamental human rights, the freedom of expression, freedom to information, the ability to organise, and therefore the freedom of association are also impacted.
Mm. Glenn Boddington, one thing you noticed from the report is which one was the most blocked of all the services?
Yes, I mean, WhatsApp is coming through, isn't it, as the most blocked, which actually, of course, you know, it is that secure, you know, end-to-end encrypted, but with massive usership. I think you say 500 million in the report, used by many, many of us every day for families, for everything, etc. But also social activism is very reliant on it, as we know, in many different places. So I'm really with you on that, that blocking of a citizen's voice, the right for expression, etc., is really not right. But this also, in a way, it leads to violence, doesn't it? When it's blocked, surely people get more frustrated, and then that will lead to unrest. So, and equally on the other side, governments are using it, ISIS is using it, many other military. So it's quite complicated, this, yeah, the layers of what a blocking does or a stop scenario, both economically, but also in terms of how it deals with psychology and society.
Yeah, and so what should users, especially if people in some of the more oppressive regimes where we're seeing or countries that have oppressive regimes listening to this, if they're able to listen to this, what can they take away from the report, Sam, about these shutdowns or even how they can get around them?
Well, it depends on the type of restrictions that are in place. I think it's also really important to outline that censorship and surveillance often go hand in hand. So these countries that are likely to restrict internet access are also the sort of regimes that are directly monitoring what is being said and what is being done online.
Yeah.
So there are two elements to it. There is the kind of circumventing the direct blocking and the censorships, and there's also ways of staying secure online.
Okay. Well, there we're going to have to leave it. Sam Woodhams, thank you very much indeed. And also thanks to you, Simon Miliano, from Top 10 VPN. Well, we're going to go to Australia now, where it does seem as if there's a disinformation campaign raging, where, especially if you follow a hashtag like hashtag arson emergency, there are conspiracy theories that the fires are the result of arson and not climate change. Now, Timothy Graham's been looking into all this. He's a senior lecturer at the School of Communication at Queensland University of Technology. I spoke to him earlier and he began by telling me how he uses software tools to discern whether a particular Twitter account is a bot or some kind of troll or indeed like a regular human being. This is what he told me.
If the account is more likely to be human, then it will get a score closer to zero. And if it's more likely to be a bot, it will get a score closer to one. And what this does is it means that for a given hashtag, for all the users who have posted using that hashtag, we get a number for each one. And for this particular hashtag, many more of the accounts tended to be towards the bot side of the equation rather than the human side, compared or relative to the other hashtags that were going around at that point. So when you look at the distribution of the bot scores for the accounts that were posting on arson emergency, and you compare that distribution to, you know, some of the more general hashtags, again, it's just sort of off the charts, really. There's much higher proportion, such a higher concentration of accounts that exhibit strongly bot-like characteristics. And really, those were the alarm bells that were ringing for me when I first saw the results of running this data analysis.
I was looking at some of the tweets on the arson emergency hashtag, and for instance, there's one here. It says, have you noticed that climate scientists have gone very quiet on polar ice caps melting? That's because, in capital letters, ice caps are growing, says the tweet. That's probably where they switched tactics to start lighting bushfires instead. I have no idea if that's a human or a bot that's tweeted that, but it gives you an idea of the, at least the flavour of the kind of tweets that are going out on that hashtag arson emergency.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me laugh, but it is rather concerning that that is typical of the flavor of tweets that were going out around the arson emergency hashtag. So when I talk about bots, I mean, for this hashtag and really for the disinformation that we've seen going around during the bushfires, I think it, in many ways, it's more characteristic of troll bots or troll accounts. These are accounts that are primarily driven by humans, but they might be people who are being paid to sit there and to actively push conspiracy theories about X or Y topic. And in this case, to push conspiracy theories about the cause of the bushfires in order to confuse people, to sow doubt in people's minds about what's happening and to disrupt their ability to discern truth and to be able to get factual information. Perhaps it's not so surprising, but what we've found looking into this more is that many of these accounts, they appear to be most active in other countries. So it's very likely that it's either extremely partisan fringe humans who are sitting there all day saying things like that and pushing this kind of agenda, which in itself is a very worrying prospect, or it's an attempt to kind of astroturf this issue and to draw it into a global disinformation space around climate denial. I mean, we're not sure who would be responsible for setting up these accounts and for controlling them, but certainly it appears that in some ways this is so much bigger than Australia. What the bushfires have done and what this kind of disinformation has shown is that it's really propelled us into a much broader systemic kind of global issue around skepticism of science, a decline in trust in scientific authority, the rise of populism. You know, I mean, these are really systemic issues. There's more than 70 countries who are being targeted at the moment by disinformation campaigners. And I really think in some ways, the kinds of accounts that we see, the kinds of tweets that you just mentioned, show that Australia has been, you know, for better or worse, pulled into this global online space.
Do you see similarities here between what's going on in this Australian case and previous disinformation campaigns, like, for instance, you know, the Russian trolls in the 2016 US election?
That's a good question. And I do in some ways see that there are some parallels to what we've learned about Russian troll activity. Now, this isn't to suggest by any means that the disinformation that's happening in Australia for the bushfires is driven from Russia or even whether it's foreign interference at all. And in Australia, what we're seeing at the moment, and the more that I and the team of researchers who I work with here are realizing, is that there appear to be troll and maybe bot-like accounts who are pushing a left agenda and in trying to actually play into the furor and the confusion that there's been around the disinformation itself. So there are accounts that have a high likelihood to be trolls or to be bots, and they're actually pretending to be hyper-partisan, left-leaning individuals who are calling into question everything. You know, you can't trust the media, you can't trust the right, you can't even trust the left. Overall, I think what this shows is that whoever's behind this, they stand to benefit from confusion, from creating anxieties, from stirring up an already polarized environment. And so it's this kind of chaos that I think is quite reticent of what happened in 2016 in the US.
That's Timothy Graham. Ghislain Boddington was listening to that here in the studio in London.
Yes, fascinating to hear the kind of breakdown that is possible nowadays on this, and we need it. We need to start to understand the depth of this disinformation. And in this case on climate change, we've had Greta Thunberg today talking at Davos, in a way saying the same thing. We've got to listen. We've got to get the facts on the table. And to stop this kind of disinformation is what's going to help the next generations take the right action. Right action for Australia and for the bushfires onwards is really important, because it's not just 1 year. It's This is an ongoing scenario. So in a way, it's a bit like back engineering, isn't it? Using the disinformation to actually create better information. Yeah. I think this can happen.
Yeah, OK. Well, Ghislain, thank you for that. Well, now, the UN has just declared an international decade of Indigenous languages. It's to begin in 2022. And that follows on from the 2019 Year of Indigenous Languages. And that's really set us wondering how you get languages online. For instance, Cherokee, an endangered language of the Americas, originally an oral language until fairly recently. This became written down in the 19th century. Well, I've been hearing more on all this from Dr. Craig Cornelius, who's a senior software engineer at Google. So the question is, how do you get a whole language onto our devices?
The first thing is to make sure that the people have a way of writing their language. As most folks know, there are different ways of writing the languages. Chinese, of course, is well known, having a very different writing system, but Cyrillic is used for many languages. Greek is another writing system. Burmese and many writing systems of the Indian subcontinent, almost all of them are standardized now in something called the Unicode standard, which basically assigns a different number for every character in all these writing systems. There are a few languages around the world which still are not standardized in the Unicode standard, but almost all are. Once that part is done, in other words, the writing is set up so that any computer can understand it, then a person needs a font to display the characters in that and a way of entering the characters, basically a keyboard input device of some sort. And with the current smartphones, building software to display any characters is actually quite straightforward.
Yours is such a fascinating job, and I know you have this lovely story about meeting two brothers from Africa, and they had a particular challenge for you, didn't they?
I heard about the brothers from an Atlantic magazine article, and it was indicated that they are doing something very much like what the Cherokee Nation did 200 years ago. They invented a writing system for their language, which is called Pular. They are also called the Fulani people, and they're spread across about 20-plus countries in Africa, just south of the Sahara Desert, all the way from the Sudan west to Mauritania and Guinea. These brothers invented a way of writing their language because there was no standard way of writing it. And it turns out that it was phonetic and very easy for people to learn, and people started using it even without being taught formally. So all of a sudden, people have a way of writing their language, and they are using it. They worked with the Unicode standard and got the characters, which is a fairly small alphabet, like 28 characters, into the standard. And then nobody did anything for them. No computer companies stepped up. But I contacted them, and they called me back, and we started a conversation. We actually were able to get a font and then push that so that it would be in Android phones. And then we developed a keyboard for it. And now people are using it in Africa. It is something that is changing lives, because texting is a very common way of operating in Africa, texting is much cheaper than voice calls. So this makes it possible for it to communicate in their language at a much lower cost. And it's also becoming a literacy program in Africa, because now that people can read and write their language, they are learning to read and write in Pular.
What are the next big developments that you see coming up, or even the big challenges that still need to be met?
Well, one of the big challenges in the field is first finishing the set of languages that people actually read and write. There are about 7,000 languages in the world, and over half of those have some written form, but many people are illiterate in their own languages, even if there is a way of writing them. So for us to develop ways that every written language can be used on all devices is really important, and that means building lots of keyboards and making sure fonts are available everywhere. One of the next big challenges is doing something for the 3,000 languages that don't have a written form. Of course, people today can use audio recording and can use video online and communicate well that way. But at some point, somebody needs to have some text in there to at least identify what the videos and the audios are in terms of what languages they are. And many people are working to develop writing systems for those. After that, once we can get everybody doing basic communications, then people naturally expect that all sorts of other things will start working. And they don't work by magic. For example, people can log in and type in many languages using Latin characters. But if you're a Sami person in northern Norway, when you type, the spell corrector will think you're typing Norwegian. And it will underline or indicate that every word you're typing is wrong. So spell correction for every language and suggestions for the words that come up when you're typing words on your smartphone. Those are things that could be developed for every language. That will take a lot of time and a lot of work with every indigenous community around the world to make that possible. And then the ultimate goal would be to have machine translation for every language. That's a very high goal and may not be possible in the near term. But the way things are changing, perhaps this will become possible in the future.
That's Craig Cornelius. So, Glenn Boddington, it's about language, and that goes without saying, but there's a bigger picture here, isn't there, about culture overall?
No, there absolutely is, and I think it's really positive to see Google and other bigger or weaker companies approaching this so sensitively, actually, with this indigenous language thing as something that needs to be cared for and looked after. And we know that it links to heritage and archiving, but actually languages are living things, yeah. And I think that when you learn a language, you learn so much about that culture and how those people think and how life evolves and where things go, why life works like that. So the fact that people absolutely, of course, need to communicate in their native languages, and it's wonderful that these keyboards are coming about. Yes.
And that language is indeed, it's dynamic. Language isn't just a fixed thing. So you bring the tech in and it can reflect and even drive the dynamism of language and the development of culture.
Develop it all and we all learn more about each other. Yes, so...
Great, Glenn, thank you. Well, finally, robotic worms that can sniff out people. Possibly the future of search and rescue, maybe into search and rescue. Our reporter Jason Hoskin has been to the lab where they're developing chemical sensors that could help trace people who have perhaps been trapped under rubble following a natural disaster. Along with the various crisis people and friend-finding apps, it's one of the many tech responses to emergency situations. The robotic worm could end up assisting or indeed reducing the need for especially trained sniffer dogs. Jason Hoskin's report begins with a first responder.
If we imagine a scene, a building collapse, we can go from crawling around, using a mirror on a stick, call and listen. Then we might add a CO2 probe to see if someone's breathing in a void. We might add to that a thermal image camera, which sees heat as a picture.
That's Dan Cook. He's the operations director for Servon, a UK-based international search and rescue charity. He's telling me how they go about searching for people in the event of a natural disaster.
And of course, if we take them with us, we have exceptional search and rescue dogs. They're air-scenting dogs that bounce off a scent and they tell you if they think they've got somebody alive. And quite often we'll move to a seismic and acoustic search. And that actually picks up tiny vibrations made by a person and turns that into sound that you can listen to.
This is what Dan hears if someone's tapping the surface that the seismic probes are placed on.
The technical stuff only goes so far. So yes, you're doing lots of figuring out. Yes, you're speaking to people. And you also have an instinct for certain things as well. So in no time, there's a horrendous smell of dead bodies. It's really unpleasant. After a few days, you kind of get tuned into, if there's a person missing here and it's one person, you can smell whether they're dead or not. Those types of things start to become normal. So you're blending all of the technical, human, and any other aspect you can to make a success out of it.
But the technical aspect might become more useful in the future. An international team of researchers have started building a toolkit called Cursor to help out people like Dan on the ground. Professor Krishna Persaud is designing sensors which would be part of small, worm-like robots to be deployed in these disaster areas, which would sense the chemicals that indicate that there is human life under the debris.
What your research here at the University of Manchester is effectively doing is almost like the noses to these robots, detecting the smells and other signals.
Exactly. The idea is that these small robots tunnel through crevices, searching for people who won't be buried.
Human life gives off a number of smells, from sweat, urine, feces, maybe blood, and if they're breathing, they'll emit carbon dioxide. I wanted to get an idea of how the sensors on tiny worm robots would be able to detect these chemicals.
They're very tiny, about 100 microns by 60 microns. You think of a very sharp pencil point, it's the size of that point. And that's where volatile molecules absorb from the air. And then when they hit that surface, they transduce a signal, which is a current. And we measure that change in current as an indication that we're detecting a chemical.
And that could certainly detect me about half a metre away from it, but how far away could it detect the chemicals coming from my body?
Well, that's a good question. If you think of a very complex background that we might have in the field, where you might have background odours, environmental interferences like smoke, fires, then it could be quite difficult to detect a person unless you're quite close.
Now we're going up to the labs to see how the sensors respond to particular odours.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Marissa, my PhD student, she's going to be presenting an odour to the sensors there. And this is the response that you see in real time to that compound.
So the graph dipped really quickly then.
That's right.
That means that the sensor detected the odour very quickly, which provides us with information on what the chemical is. If we present the sensor with a different smell...
And you can see actually a different type of response.
So the one you've just plugged in, that's giving a much larger displacement and an even more rapid change.
Exactly, yes.
So if both of those compounds were present, you'd be able to distinguish between the two.
Exactly. So we can now focus in on compounds of interest, and we can detect individual chemicals in a very complex background.
Let's go back to Dan. How would he feel about working with these mechanical worms?
This technology, it involves quite a few steps. So it involves scientists being in a control room, actually seeing that the worm is sensing these things and then telling the guys on the ground like you what they found and where to go. Do you feel like those extra steps might actually hinder your operations?
New things and change are a challenge for everybody. It might inhibit it, but if it's possible, it's possible probably to do it faster and faster and faster.
So ultimately, would you rather be down there with these little worm robots, or would you be with your trusty mirror on a stick?
I think I'd still have a mirror on a stick, but I would love to see it happen, love to have a look at it. I think you've got to always have many tools in your box.
That's first responder Dan Cook ending that report from Jason Hoskin. And we heard about a host of technology in that piece, Glenn, you know, these chemical sensors. And I suppose there needs to be a whole load of data processing on whatever these robotic noses on the ends of the robotic worms detect.
Yes, I mean, it's really interesting because it's like a chain that they're using. It's quite clear the human is essential. The dogs are still essential. But the sensors can add into this. And yet, you know, still very base tools like the mirror on a stick are very essential. So it's actually a convergence, isn't it, of several things into what I think we should call rescue tech. Yeah.
Oh, can we coin that phrase?
I think we, let's see. It might have been a coined phrase
#rescue tech.
Hashtag rescue tech. To deal with natural disasters and man-made disasters, I guess. But we've covered things like drones, of course, and the Haiti stuff and, you know, drones dealing with where people are, and also getting tethered drones, getting mobile contact back for people, etc. Blood deliveries.
And robot vision, for instance, you know, using another sense. But this whole point that if you are in some kind of emergency situation, yes, you get a signal from the chemical nose on the end of your robotic worm, that still needs processing, that can still take some time, the back end, is that an issue, do you think?
I think it probably is, and I think I wanted to explore that with you, because it seems like it might be quite a big back end scenario. And I wonder, because this is real time work.
Yeah.
And
no,
it really
critical.
Needs to be on site, doesn't it? So surely the back end analysis needs to be a mobile scenario.
We would assume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That needs to happen anyway.
Yeah, indeed. So it's the detection and the processing. That's what we got from that.
Yes.
Well, that is Ghislaine Boddington. Thank you very much, Ghislaine. I'm Gareth Mitchell. Your producer today is Anya Litterovich, and you're a lovely listener. See you next week. And goodbye. Well, thank you very much for staying back for the podcast edition. So the rest of the world, Ghislaine Boddington's now listening to the news, I think.
Yes.
We're just here podcasting away.
Chatting away with the good guests we've got with us today.
Yeah, yeah. Indeed. Simon and Sam have both stayed back from the top 10 VPN websites. We were talking about the shutdowns in the programme. So let's pick that conversation up again, because what we didn't get a chance to talk about, first to you, Simon Miliano, is just the like kind of how you sort of do this research. You know, we got an idea in the program of roughly where some of these figures come from, but you're putting together a lot of data and you're working with, it's NetBlocks, isn't it?
So. Yeah, we used NetBlocks tooling that they created with the Internet Society.
Yeah, and just tell us who they are. We've mentioned them on the program in the past, but just remind me.
Yeah, so NetBlocks is a non-profit internet monitoring service, and the Internet Society, of course, a very well-known advocacy group for the internet, protecting it from the forces that might destroy it.
Yes.
So we use their tooling that's publicly available, combined with a data set that we created, that was made from, we looked at every single internet shutdown that happened in 2019, and there were very, very many.
Yeah.
And we identified and categorised each one to determine the duration of each one, and also to categorise what type of shutdown, whether it was an internet blackout, a social media shutdown. And by combining the data set with that publicly available tooling, we were able to calculate the cost of each individual shutdown and aggregate them into that big figure that we have.
So you were sort of starting with that data. And I remember, because we had NetBlocks on not so long ago, and we did what I thought was a fascinating bit of Pod Extra stuff, actually, that, again, didn't fit in the programme. But it's where they were talking about some of the hardware that they have out there, and indeed software, obviously, but kind of embedding little boxes, often those miniature Raspberry Pi computers, into various strategically located servers in order to be almost like an observatory that could tell you remotely what was going on in Iraq or somewhere like that. It was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, the work that Alpany's team does is incredible. And without that work, we wouldn't have been able to create this report year. So we're very indebted to their work.
Yeah, well, as are we, because we're here talking about it. And Sam, you're especially interested in the whole digital activism side of things and the use of VPNs to allow people to still have their voices, to be able to get online. Maybe give us a sense of how it is being used. Is it circumventing censorship? Is it partly just so that protests can be mobilised in some way, getting an information flow in and out of countries with regimes that block information flows? What kinds of activism do we see?
Well, I think it depends in which area you're looking at. The use of various different tools, it kind of depends on what is trying to be done. So if there is an internet blackout where there is no internet at all, there's been evidence of an increase in use in mesh networking, where people can therefore communicate freely with one another through a network of Bluetooth connections. With social media restrictions, there's more use of VPNs because it allows you to circumvent those blocks. But with internet blackouts, for the ordinary citizens, there's almost no way to get online.
That's fascinating what you're saying about Bluetooth mesh network. So this is where you can just do away with needing mobile phone towers or the internet. And for instance, my phone could talk to your phone and then Ghislaine's phone and Simon's phone through the Bluetooth. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, there are some limitations with it. Distance being the major
that's what
one.
I thought. It's
your
only
Bluetooth
a
connection
few meters,
can
isn't
only
it?
Go so far. But if you're in a highly densely populated area, so we've seen it being used in Hong Kong during the protests, then that can be a great way of people staying in contact.
So all four of us are at a protest together, so we're meters away from each other, and the mobile phone masts or the mobile phone networks are either down or they've been blocked or what have you, and then we can informally set up a mesh network amongst our phones. And what are there apps that people can buy that allow them to do that? Or do you have to hack the phone, do you know? Or?
No, there are various apps available, and a lot of them are free and run on open source code as well.
Yeah. So
I think they're used in nightclubs for dating and things, aren't they? Some of those kinds of things.
I need to go out and watch it. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, said, you know, sounds a bit, I've never encountered it, but you suddenly get a picture. And somebody, you're like, oh, right, it's that guy by the bar. He sent me a picture. Yeah, so if you've opened up to it, yeah, opened up to receive those. Mm. So, but in this case, obviously, this is quite serious use. And I've been interested in actually how this works when there's all sides are using these social media things like WhatsApp or Telegram or Signal or whatever, but maybe the military's using it, maybe the terrorists or the campaign groups against it using, maybe the civil society's using it together. And what happens then when that it all goes down? Can governments just take out their own communication networks too when it's working through the military as well?
Yes. The issue with these sorts of restrictions when you implement a blanket ban on something like WhatsApp is that you're not just affecting, a government will often say what they're doing is preventing terrorists from talking to each other, from communicating, or a lot of the time to stop the spread of disinformation and the effects that that can have. But because of its kind of disproportionate implementation, it affects everyone. So that means that families can't stay in touch. And it's a major problem.
And you mentioned their disinformation, and I'm so glad you did that, because I wanted to find a way of getting back to Timothy Graham, who we also heard in the programme. So this is the Queensland University of Technology researcher who's been looking at the disinformation campaign that seems to be raging across the social media in the Australia bushfires context. And again, because in the podcast, what I really like to do is to do that deeper dive into the really techie bits that we just can't do in a 4.5 minute live on the programme. And I wanted Timothy just to give me a little bit more detail about the tools that he uses to discern whether tweets are coming from bots or humans. And this is what he told me about the tools that he uses.
I just turned to this software programme called Twint. It's an advanced Twitter scraping tool. It's written in the Python language, and it enables you to basically scrape Twitter data from Twitter profiles, from tweets. That's the first piece of the puzzle. You know, you need to collect the data. Then the question is, well, if you have some data and you want to analyze bot activity, you can use any number of kind of state-of-the-art bot detection tools to do that. The one that I've used the most in my research is actually a tool called Botometer. It takes Twitter profile data as input. It analyzes the data and, in a sense, matches the characteristics of these accounts. So, you know, how often do they post? What are they posting about? What is the network structure of their follower or their social ties? And then at the end, it kind of spits out some metrics which tell you how likely Botometer believes that account is to be a bot.
What about for the rest of us then? If we get a suspicion that a particular Twitter account is a bot, what are we looking out for? Is it the way that the messages are framed, the way that the same message comes out at the same time every day? In other words, what kind of signatures do they have that might give them away?
So many bot accounts are created really quickly. They're cheap, nasty, quick ways to get the job done, and then they get shut down. So if there's no profile picture, or if there is a profile picture and then you do a reverse image search on it and it turns up to be around thousands of places on the internet, then, that's not that real person. That's just some image that they've stolen from social media or from Google Image. Accounts that all have no profile image, they have dodgy-looking names like Tim101015 or something like that, and had been created like 2 weeks ago, you know, during a crisis event or something like that. Once you sum up all of that evidence, I think that you start to get a fairly clear idea that this isn't a real person driving this account. But then when you start to look at the content, so if you start to just scroll through the most recent tweets and replies, bots tend to just retweet things. So you don't almost ever see in the wild a bot that's capable of actually having a conversation. Like, really what they do is they just retweet, you know, over and over and over at high frequency. And they're doing it like every 5 or 10 minutes, like all day. This is another major red flag. You just sum up the evidence and arrive, I suppose, at your own conclusion about how willing you are to say that this account is automated.
That is Timothy Graham giving you a few tips there about working out whether that Twitter account you're looking at is a bot or is a real person. So this is why we love the intro.
Complicated.
We can get that extra context.
Yes, but it is very important for us all to actually understand more about this. Yeah. And the more we can get it explained by people like Timothy and yourself asking the good questions and helps us all. Because we've got to keep this in mind and we've got to start to understand.
There's a lot at stake just being able to work out the veracity of where your information's coming from. Now, luckily, we have two VPN experts in the room. And I do want to come back to one of them, Simon. Just to see briefly where the state of the art is going in VPNs, because I've used them occasionally, like journalistically, if I'm operating in a country where certain services or sites are blocked. And of course, they're great, they're very enabling, but quite often it slows your device down, it runs down the battery life. Using a VPN sometimes can be a pretty miserable experience, but again, at least you're getting online and you're getting the information. Is it improving? What's the state of the art? Where's it going?
It certainly is improving. I think over the past 3 or 4 years, there's been such an upsurge in demand for VPNs, not just amongst professionals like journalists and digital rights activists, but amongst ordinary people, that there's been new companies entering the market and they're really investing in the infrastructure. You know, rather than having a few slow servers dotted around the world, they've got massive server networks of thousands, even tens of thousands of servers, and armies of, you know, really talented people working on the tech. And we've met those people, and they're pretty incredible what they're doing. Now, they're a small group of, I guess, pioneers, but they're the rising tide that raises all boats. So I'm confident that over the next couple of years, even more VPNs will get better and become just a better product. But the flip side is there's an awful lot of terrible VPNs out there, particularly free ones, because, you know, there's people looking to make a buck off that demand.
Yeah. Oh, if only there was a good referral website to help us.
If only.
The good ones from the bad ones, Ghislaine Boddington. And I've got one more clip to play, actually. And Ghislaine, sometimes when Bill's here, he helps me with the sudden radio gear changes we have
to do. Yes, of course.
So we've got to somehow get from VPNs to going back to introducing new languages onto Google services, for instance.
I mean, that's not so hard, because we know that many of these new languages, which are fascinatingly needed to come in, are for very small communities of people and tribes that actually do need to have their community links quite strongly in place.
Oh, yeah, you're such a pro, Ghislaine Boddington, because the best I could come up with is that, you know, that VPN has become a new term in many of our languages, and that takes us conveniently back to, your way was much better than mine, to Dr. Craig Cornelius, who we heard in the programme. This is the senior software engineer at Google, you know, who's telling us about getting new languages onto our devices and all that. But then one thing he really wanted to point out is that there are more languages available than you might necessarily think. This is what he had to say.
One of the things that's changing things very rapidly is that people can develop keyboards on their own. Google has also developed over 900 different keyboards for the Android phones, and many people don't even know that they are there. So many languages are possible right now. One of the biggest challenges for us is helping people discover that their keyboards are out there. And in many cases, they already have data collected, so spell correction and text suggestions are there in languages. I just talked to some people for the Tongan language, and they were very surprised to see that the Tongan keyboard is already available to them, and I'm hoping they'll start using it.
So you probably get people saying, it's so unfair, why isn't my language on Android? And you're like, yes, it's been there for 3 years. Just go and check out the keyboard, we've already done it.
Well, in most cases, it's more recent than 3 years, but we made a tremendous effort, and we are very excited when people find that they can communicate in their native languages the way they want to on the internet. It shouldn't be forced to be in French or English or Spanish. There are millions of people who would prefer their own languages and their own writing systems, and the internet is making all that possible now. It's also important to note that when there's a standard way of writing all the characters, which the Unicode standard provides, then people can use all the tools that are available online, not just typing, but things like internet search. They can use documents both on their computers and online. They can create content, transmit content. It all becomes very natural once they have their language in the standard. So it's an amazing time when this is becoming available to everyone.
That's Craig Cornelius, a bit of pod extra for him, or from him, for you, from us. Okay, just time again in Boddington very quickly to congratulate a few of the listeners who have flown through our listener exam.
Right. So new listeners this week. Not new listeners, new members of the Digital Planet Listeners
Group. Exactly, who have proven that they're not a bot or a troll. They would have passed the Timothy Graham test.
Yes.
A lot of what Timothy Graham said is kind of like the Turing test, in a way. I just thought, should have put that in the programme. Too late now, it's been and gone. Nigel Cook has just answered both questions successfully, illustrating one of his answers by saying he wants to up the ante on Kit Rackley's claim from last week that everything links to geography. Nigel says, I can beat geography as a subject to cover all stories as I have a degree in physics and I'm now a software engineer. So I think the implication there is that physics is the bedrock of everything. Chemists, biologists, geographers, do write in.
And humanists, artists, creatives, everybody please.
Just everybody please.
The more diverse, the more innovation we have.
Otherwise, without you, the outro really does drag on, believe you me. Anyway, this is what a great outro this has been. Thank you very much to Simon Miliano and Sam Woodhams from Top 10 VPN, and you, Glenn Boddington. And that's it for Digital Planet. We're tired and we want to go home, so that's where we're going. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.